I'm not so good at using my office phone. Go figure.
All right. Okay, cool. All right, so we're just going to get right into it. Are we ready to...
Yes.
Ready to record?
Okay. We are ready, y'all, and go when you're ready.
Okay. Hello and welcome, everyone. This is Taproom Talks with Lakewood Brewing Company. I am Wim Benz. Here, as always, with me are Craig Bradley and Zach Phillips, our creative team.
Hello.
Yo.
And we have Tommy Gutierrez, who is one of our brewers and our local barrel aficionado at Lakewood Brewing Company. And on the phone, we have a very special guest. We have Jeremy Grinke, Brewery Tarot Production Manager. Say hi, Jeremy.
What's up, fellas?
Hey, man. Thanks. Thank you so much for joining us. So Jeremy came to the brewery just a couple of weeks ago. He was in town for North Texas Beer Week. Had a good time and drank a couple of beers and got to know him and said, hey, you do a lot of stuff with barrels. We're going to do this show on barrels. You want to be on the show? And here we are. So thank
yep,
you so
here we are.
Thanks so much for joining us. Why don't you tell us a little bit about, give us a little bit of history on the brewery Tarot and what you do there.
Cool. Perfect. Perfect way to start this out. So I'm Jeremy. I'm the production manager for Brewery Tarot. Brewery Tarot is kind of the new brand to focus and highlight our wild and farmhouse style ales. So the brewery obviously has been around since 2008 and been doing a lot of crazy experimental beers. Through about 6 years of doing everything in one house, you know, as many people run into problems, we ran into problems as well, which necessitated the capital expenditure to create a new facility. So I was brought on to help facilitate and run that program. So my history is I was a winemaker for several years on the Central Coast. I didn't foresee myself ending up making sour beer, but the stars aligned and I kind of wound up with this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to change career paths and actually go work for a guy, you know, by the name of Patrick Brew, who, you know, is well-respected in the beer community and had a, you know, just had the right fit for me personally. And, you know, 2 years later, we've released, you know, 90 different beers, you know, and just in my mind, we're killing it. But, you know, it's been quite the ride for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've been big fans of the brewery, or as we like to refer to it as the brewery, because it is spelled B-R-U-E-R-Y. But yeah, we've been big fans, you know, as beer drinkers first and continuing as brewers of all the stuff that you guys have put out. And, you know, really inspired us to start a sour program and to kind of, you know, follow in your footsteps a little bit and start exploring and experimenting, you know, with all the cool new things that you can do as you add that layer of complexity to craft beer, adding that sour element, adding that funky element, to the beers that we already love to make. So, hats off to you guys for kind of blazing that trail a little bit and inspiring other craft breweries.
Well, right on, and thank you, Wim. But I'll tell you what, visiting your place a couple weeks ago, I could tell you you guys are definitely on the right track.
Well, thank you.
Really,
thank you.
Really impressed by what you guys are working on.
Well, cool. Well, let's, you know, this is a little bit different than some of our other podcasts. This is just going to be kind of a big Q&A session. You know, there's a lot of interest in sour beer, you know, not just from a consumer side, but I think from, you know, a homebrew side and, you know, from a craft brew side as well. It's new. It's exciting. It's an old way of doing things. It's an older way of doing things. You know, I'm from Belgium originally. So, you know, sour beer is something that, that's been around in Belgium for quite a long time, but not necessarily in the United States. So it's still kind of fun and exciting. Here,
I could tell you as somebody who spends all day doing this that nobody knows anything. You know, we're still learning as we go as well. So to me, you know, to be a part of, you know, the sour beer community and talking with other brewers who are starting their programs or who are further ahead than we are, or even homebrewers for that matter, you know, there's a lot of information out there to share for sure.
Yeah. So let's start there. So let's why don't you talk to us a little bit, since you did come from the wine world, what are some of the parallels that you see, you know, coming out of the wine world and into the sour beer world with wine, and what are some of the challenges and some of the differences as well? Obviously, we're both using barrels.
Correct.
And you know, some different types of fermentation. So let's chat about that for a minute.
Yeah, so I think the biggest thing, you know, to get out of the way when you talk about wine versus sour beer is, you know, the elephants in the room. And, you know, those are Brett, lacto, and PDO. So obviously in wine, you're trying to control those things. In sour beer, you're trying to give them the opportunity to do what they love to do. So, I mean, that's like the big, big difference, right? So I spent years, you know, sulfuring different wines, making sure that, you know, we had a good PPM, parts per million, where we inhibited growth of these nasty little bugs, you know. So you come to the sour beer world, and you actually want to lay down a nice little place for these guys to do what they do, and mm-hmm. you want to make them happy. So once we get that out of the way, the similarities are way more than the differences.
Yeah.
So, like you said, we are using barrels. You know, we're doing barrel ferments. You do a lot of barrel ferments with white wines. You have basically the same sort of cellar management techniques. You know, you're fermenting in stainless. You're barrel aging. You're moving barrels around. You're tasting products quite often. I mean, these are all the same things you do with wine. You know, there is no way to make sour beer by leaving it alone. There's no way to make a good wine by just crushing it, fermenting it, and putting it in a barrel and not looking at it for 2 years. You know, you need to be hands-on. So those things are similar all the way through, you know. The other things that are similar are cellar management and, you know, personnel management, fermentation management, all those types of things all fall into the same place.
Mm-hmm.
Where I think my skill set translates the most, though, is in blending. And in wine blending, you know, it's kind of been set up for generations now in the U.S. And it's an interesting thing because I think that in the beer world, you know, barrel aging and blending barrel aged beer is still relatively young. And I think there's a lot of pitfalls that can happen there. In wine, it's like you blend for a plan. You blend for a specific wine. And if you have barrels of wine that don't fit with where you want this wine to be, you essentially declassify those barrels, and they are no longer part of what's going to make this $100 Cabernet, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But you might make a new wine that is maybe a $30 Cabernet that those barrels fit right into, you know, delivering on your price point. And if it doesn't even fit into that, the wine world has a full bulk market where you can liquidate your wine. The beer world kind of doesn't have that. So I think a lot of young brewers kind of fall into this pitfall of, say, we put 30 BBL in barrels to age, and we want to make a beer that's 25 BBL.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 years later, they'll make that 25 BBL beer, not thinking that they should probably kick out 50% of what they age because it's not good enough.
Right.
So I think that, you know, when it comes to some of the projects that we're doing where we're blending 200 or 250 individual beer barrels into a 300 to 400 BBL blend, I mean, I think that's really where these things, my skill set can shine, because it's obviously more important. Well, I don't know if it's so obvious, but it's more important what you don't put into a blend as what you do put into the blend. So, you know, if you're going to struggle with something, you know, struggle with those last five barrels that you're not sure of,
mm-hmm.
you know, because those are the ones that are really going to take it they're going to take it more often than not, it's going to be a negative. Mm-hmm. There are ways, it depends on the concept of your project, but there are ways where that one, you know, barrel that's slightly acetic might actually improve the overall blend. But, you know, that might be like a Flanders Red or something, you
right.
know, where it wouldn't be a Berliner, you know, obviously you're not barrel aging a Berliner, but you know what I'm saying? If it's part of the beer style, you know, maybe you can get away with it, but you got to be very careful there. And especially if you're making beers like we make, because people tend to hold on to our beers. So if you have a beer, a sour beer that's 3 years old, you know, you probably don't want that thing going in a bottle of mess. You know, you want it going in pretty clean.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
just for our listeners out there, BBL is a shorthand for a beer barrel, which is 31 gallons. That's sort of our unit of measure. You know, whenever you go to a brewery, you might ask them, hey, what size is your brew house? And they'll say, well, it's a 20 barrel or it's a 30 barrel. And that's, you multiply that by 31 and then you get your total gallons. So, so let's just say we have 10 full casks of beer. How do you go about picking the ones that, you know, cut the mustard? Are you going through a lab? Are you doing it on sensory alone? Are you doing both? What's the process?
Well, there's different processes, but so it's important to note that although I may know a lot about what the brewery does, you know, I'm focused on 40% of our total output.
Mm-hmm.
So basically I oversee all of the sour beer. So granted, if you're blending clean beers, there will be a lot of lab involvement in the selection process. So it'll be sensory and lab involvement, because obviously you need to know what you're putting together. On my end, it is much, much driven by sensory. So basically we'll lay out a plan for a finished beer, and that concept is what's going to drive the barrel selection process. So
mm-hmm.
for instance, if we're making a Flemish red, we make one every year called Oud Tart, and it's a wine barrel-aged Flemish. And we also make a goose-type blend called Ruse that basically have a different selection process. So we'll lay out, say we want to make, you actually use the reference point of 10 cask.
Yeah.
So that unfortunately for me, that's a very small blend.
Of course.
And the nuance that you can get in that blend, you might be able to pull off a Flemish-style beer with that, but pulling off like a goose-style blend is pretty much impossible with that small amount of beer.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, it's basically concept-driven. So if I'm going to use the example of a goose-style beer. So for that, I know that we need 3-year-old beer in the blend. I know that we need 2-year-old beer, and I know we need some young stock as well. So for that, basically, we're going to lay out that I want to do 300 BBL of this beer, which is going to take approximately 200 casks or barrels to make this beer. And I'm going to basically go down and we're going to taste through, say, 400 of these barrels
mm-hmm.
to try to get the best 200 we can get. And basically what I'm looking for are those subtle nuances that you want to see in the finished beer. So when you drink our Ruse beer, which, again, is our goose-style blend, when you drink that beer, you should get hints of, like, I know I hate to say lemon peel because it's a sour beer and everybody thinks lemon, but really it should have like hints of lemon peel. It should have some like stone fruit accents to it. You know, it should have a little bit of like honey taste, honey flavors. So basically when we're selecting those barrels, I'm looking for barrels that are outstanding in those categories. And so I do kind of we do like a barrel rating system. So we use stars. So if we taste a barrel that is an exceptional barrel by itself, you know, that's a 5-star barrel. Whereas, you know, something that's, you know, not quite sour, but has good barrel character, some good oak to it, you know, that might be a 3 or so. And we call that typically like a blender. That's kind of like one of the barrels that, you know, that's not going to do anything to accentuate the blend, but that's going to be a good base to blend off of.
Mm-hmm.
So then if I find a couple barrels that have good stone fruit character, those can go on top of that barrel. So there's I hate to say that it's all concept driven, but it really should be. You should know where you want to end up and then work backwards from there. I think that sometimes it could be safe to, you know, just go willy-nilly and go through your cellar and say, you know, I'm just going to take these barrels that taste really good, blend them together, and see what happens. I mean, I think that that's fair sometimes, but generally speaking, I think it's really smart to know where you want to end up and then work backwards from there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes it takes a bit of experience to figure that out, but ultimately you have to have your eye on the prize. You know, you got to know what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that really answers your full question, but I mean, I'm thinking that kind of does a little bit.
No, I think that makes perfect sense. You know, it's just from a logistics standpoint. I mean, you're coming up with the name of the beer. You're coming up with a label. You're going through label approvals through the state and through TTB. I mean, there's this whole other packaging side of stuff that needs to get done. And you better make sure that the beer that's going in the bottle is what you're promising on the label. So it makes perfect sense to, you know, to work backwards from that concept.
Yeah, and the other thing with that, too, is, like, since the brewery was making a ton of sour beer for a ton of years, there's a lot of beers that we make here at Taru that are continuations of a brewery legacy. So I mentioned Oud Tart and Ruse. Mm-hmm. You know, those are beers that the brewery's made for 7 years. And so we're taking that over and putting a new label on it. But, you know, it better stay in the lineage, so to speak. You know, the last thing we want to do is, I want to improve beer, for sure, no doubt about it. Every time we make it, we want to improve it. But I don't necessarily want to change it in a way that's not descriptive of just the vintage. You know, there's a little bit of room in sour beer and vintaging to say, hey, the beer we made this year is different than the beer we made last year because
sure.
we made it this year.
Right.
You know, obviously it's different.
Yeah.
But it should still be in the same lineage, so to speak. So that's tricky. So I guess there is a little bit, like I said earlier, the willy-nilly style. You can get a little bit willy-nilly on a new project because you don't know exactly how it's going to finish or where it's going to go.
Right.
But generally speaking, you're kind of painting yourself in a corner if you don't try to plan something. You know, you have to have something out there. It's like starting a business without a business plan. You
right.
know, not a smart thing.
Exactly.
So.
Exactly. Okay, we got to take a little break, guys. We'll be right back with releases. All right, guys, I got a couple of releases to tell you about. Drumroll, please. Today is Monday, and today is BBT release day. Yay!
BBT, what is that, Wim?
BBT, oh, that's our...
what is that?
That's our... It's our Bourbon Barrel Temptress.
Oh, I think I've heard of that.
It's, you may have heard of it.
Yeah.
It's awesome. This year, it's awesome. It's awesome every year.
No explanation needed.
It's a big one this year. We're mm-hmm. We're over 11% this year,
mm-hmm.
and it's great. The barrels were great. It's got a lot of good bourbon notes to it. Everything you expect from Temptress, all the chocolate and caramel, and we're excited about it. I think it's going to age pretty well. Mm-hmm. If you are going to age it properly.
Yeah,
upright at
55 degrees
or less.
And this year's was aged in Breckenridge Distillery barrels.
Yeah,
Colorado.
Came out
yeah.
really, really well.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. Other things to tell you about Till and Toil. Till and Toil, which is our farmhouse saison,
mm-hmm.
our spring seasonal, will be hitting the stores January 3rd. So keep an eye out for that.
Mm-hmm.
We also have red wine barrel aged Till and Toil that will be dropping a little bit later mm-hmm. in the winter spring time. So mm-hmm. keep your eye out for that. We'll be bottling that for the first time this year. The other release I got to tell you about is Raspberry Temptress. Raspberry Temptress was in a bomber. It is now available in 4-packs.
Yeah.
All of our Seduction Series beers will be available in 4-packs this year going forward. I think a lot of people realize that a bomber of Temptress was a little bit of a commitment.
It's hard to get through by yourself.
It's a little mm-hmm. bit of a commitment. So we changed it up.
Now you don't have to.
Now you can drink alone.
Yeah.
Now you can pace yourself. So it's Raspberry Temptress coming out in 4-packs January 3rd. Go to your local grocery store. All right, let's get back to Jeremy Grinke.
Yeah.
Well, so let's just kind of back it up a little bit. So we've talked about Brett and Lacto and PDO, you know, the big three souring agents, let's say. Why don't you talk about what each one of those brings to the party?
Cool. So we typically have all three of those party guys in our beer. So we do a lot of barrel aging here, and all of our barrel aged beer starts fermentation life in puncheons. For those that don't know, a puncheon is a very large barrel. The barrels we use, the puncheons we have, are 500 liters. So that translates to 132 gallons. And we use those as primary fermentation vessels for all of our barrel-aged beer. Basically, we bring over wort from the brewery. That's another interesting point. I don't have a brew house here at my facility, so we are actually trucking over 30 barrels of wort at a time from the brewery brew house.
And how far apart are you guys?
We are 3 miles apart.
Okay, so not too bad.
Yeah, no, not too bad. So they'll knock out over there, and about 20 minutes later, we receive tote tanks of wort here. But anyway, that wort goes into our primary fermentation puncheons. And inside those puncheons is our house mix culture that we have been consistently using for all of our barrel-aged beer. So in that, we have who knows how many Brett strains at this point, at least five. We have Brett Brux, Brett Dre, Brett Clausini, Lambicus, and Fantôme. We have all of those in there, and then a little bit of Trois, and there's probably some other Saccharomyces yeast that are just hanging out in there because we're not trying to control that so much as get as what we are trying to control in barrel aging. So basically what I mean by that is we're letting those guys do the work to get the beer attenuated to a acceptable level where we could transfer that to barrels. And by attenuated, for those who don't know, I'm basically talking about we eat all the sugar down so that when we put it in barrels, it's somewhat stable and it's not actively fermenting in a primary state. Mm-hmm. But inside those puncheons as well, we have several different lacto cultures and several different PDO cultures. And basically the lactic cultures are giving us that quicker souring. So we will see this wort in puncheons in a primary fermentation for anywhere from 2 weeks to 4 weeks. And in that 2 weeks to 4 weeks, not only will we get attenuation of the wort into beer, but we will also get the quick souring of the lactobacteria that's in there. Mm-hmm. Now, the PDO is in there as well, but the PDO is doing, like, the long-term work. So once we transfer these puncheons, every one of these puncheons basically gets, let's say, 120 gallons of beer put into it, of wort that turns into beer, and then we transfer from those puncheons into regular size wine barrels for long-term aging. And the long-term aging is really where the PDO comes in, and that's that slow souring bacteria. It's also, you know, the bacteria that can, in bad situations, can create some diacetyl. Mm-hmm. But all of the Brett that's in the primary fermentation will help clean that up. So, you know, we basically have the three stages of, you know, what the yeast does versus what the lacto does versus what the PDO does. And that's for our barrel-aged beer. So all of those things are in there because they're going to get in there anyway. So if you're using wine barrels for your barrel aging, there's no way to not have lacto in there. There's no way to not have PDO, and there's no way to not have Brett. That's all going to be in there. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of, do you want to let it do itself on its own, or do you want to give it a prescription and say, these are the things we want in there? And so that's what we choose to do. We do that in our primary fermentation puncheons, and then we wait. Tick tock goes the clock.
Are you guys reusing those secondary wine barrels that you're after the puncheons?
We do, yeah. So we reuse a sour barrel that's in our cellar as many times as we can. We have some barrels that have had 10 turns. I'm sure there's a couple barrels in our cellar that were here when the brewery started making sour beer. So basically, we only get rid of barrels when the beer in the barrel is bad. And by bad, I mean...
got some bad off flavors that you're not too fond of.
Yeah, too far gone. Like sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, we have beers that are just horrible. They're super acetic or ethyl acetate and acetone. Mm-hmm. Those barrels get dumped immediately and trashed. We also have barrels of beer that kind of get away from us a little bit where... You know, it's got a little bit of ethyl acetate that if you let it alone, you know, it's going to turn to acetone. So sometimes we find a way to incorporate something like that into a blend. It's not often, but sometimes that happens. Or we'll put fruit on it or something, and we'll try to see. It's not really a way of covering up. It's more of a way of like, well, let's see if we kickstart this fermentation again in a secondary format with some fruit, what happens to that beer. And usually it's, you know, it's a small expenditure to see what happens. But basically, as a rule of thumb, if the beer is bad, you dump it and the barrel goes in the trash. If the beer has an off flavor we can work out or use to our benefit in blending, we may consume the beer, but the barrel for sure is trashed. So no matter what, if there's an off flavor in the beer that's in a barrel, that barrel is discarded and never filled again.
Any fooders or anything?
Yeah, we have two fooders. We have two 250 barrel fooders.
Ooh, that's a big fooder.
They are big fooders. We sourced them through Fooder Crafters in Missouri.
Yeah.
We got them first week of December last year, so we're right about our year anniversary of getting those things in. And I'm glad you brought those up because that is basically dedicated for our Berliner style project right now. Which is interesting because it's completely different than what we just discussed about barrels. So with that beer, it's actually a sour beer that we designed. So that beer in the fooders has no PDO. It only has lacto. We have three different lacto strains in there. We have Brevis, Delbrueckii, and Acidophilus in there. And then we're also fermenting with two Brett strains. So basically, our fooders are kind of our quick turn sour. So we're looking at, we basically use a Solera method in those fooders.
And
so
talk about that, yeah.
Yeah, so when we first started those fooders, we were bringing wort over and then pitching lacto into the wort. So we're doing some pre-souring, pre-acidification techniques. Important to note that we don't do any kettle souring here, but we have played around with this pre-acidification of the wort. And so we'd leave the lacto in there for about 2 days until we started dropping in pH and getting up our TA. And then we'd go ahead and pump that wort into the fooder, and then we inoculated it with two different forms of Brett and let it ferment, right? And as we kept knocking out wort into there, we for the first, I think, four brews we did, we acidified, and then fermented, you know, until we got the fooder almost full. And then we decided, well, hey, what would it hurt at this point to just try pumping some wort in there? Let's not acidify it, and let's see what happens, you know. And what we found is that it didn't matter, that we had such the bacterial load in there at that point that the beer behaved the same way. Within a day, the wort had acidified, it was fermenting, and within 2 weeks, it was attenuated. So it's actually become quite the useful tool because at this point right now for this beer, we're pulling say 90 barrels out of the fooder on day one, putting that into a secondary tank for fruit re-fermentation. And then the next day, we just start pumping wort right back into that fooder. And we set the fooder on a recirc. It acidifies and ferments just in a couple weeks, and we're back to where we started on day one. So it's actually been a pretty cool project. But by quick turn, basically that allows us to have a lower price point on that beer, and then differentiate between what we do on barrel aging and what we do on the quick turn side.
Right.
So it kind of gets us into that, how do I say it? It kind of gets us into that, you know, kettle sour price point, so to speak.
Yeah, sure. You also have a much more, I guess, consistent product, too, with doing that kind of thing.
No doubt, yeah. And it's actually quite a nice little beer. And it's going to see a ton of distribution next year, so we're really looking forward to that. The beer, the base beer is called Frucht, and Frucht is German for fruit. And so basically we do this Berliner beer, and then as I said earlier in this conversation, we take that out into tote tanks and we do secondary fermentation with different fruits. So, you know, the last one we just released is called Frucht Cherry, and the next one we have coming up is Frucht something else, you know. So
you're doing
it's a nice quick turn, you know, $11 beer that... fun to drink and easy to make. And, you know, with doing the amount of barrel aging here that we do, I need a couple easy to make beers.
Sure.
So
you're doing the secondary on that in totes with the
fruit?
Yeah,
well, we actually, we do it anywhere we can do it. So I have three 90-barrel stainless fermenters here, and if we don't have a stainless beer coming through and I see, you know, a three-week opportunity to use that vessel, I'll use that.
Just whatever tank you have open.
But we do use a lot of totes. I have we have four tote tanks here that are dedicated just for wort transport, and then I think I have – there are 13 or 14 550-gallon totes that we use for blending purposes, storage purposes, fruit, secondary fermentation purposes. You know, they're basically just, you know, tools in the shed, and I'll use them any way I can. So,
I did have a question about – you said you used Lactobacillus acidophilus in, yeah, in that blend. Are you seeing any acetic acid production?
Oh,
no.
we're getting real technical now.
Yeah. No, actually, this beer is not seeing any of that. It is super clean.
Cool. I've been hesitant to try using it because of that.
Yeah, well, what I can tell you about it is it gets stuff really sour.
Okay.
No doubt about that. This beer is sour.
I've used Planetarum a couple times on pre-acidification of wort, and it's worked out pretty well, and it's kind of it's dropped the pH really quickly too.
Yeah, nice.
So another question I had about, so you have all these barrels, what are you guys doing for barrel maintenance to keep up with them? You're reusing them pretty often, so
yeah, well, I'm a big fan of barrel maintenance in real time, so I'm kind of on my staff all the time about, you know, identifying problems and working on them when it's appropriate time to work on them. So, in other words, you know, I don't really want to dig out a barrel that has a little bit of a pinhole leak or something like that. Mm-hmm. I'd rather show these guys how to fix them in place. Or, like, you know, this is my big thing, is like when we're handling stuff, that's when we're inspecting stuff, that's when we're doing stuff, you know, that's when we're cleaning things. You know, it's a big deal to me, the quality of the inside of the barrel. It's equally a big deal to me, the quality of the outside of the barrel.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I come from the wine world where cellar presentation is very, very important, and I hold my guys to a pretty high standard here for the same things. And so, you know, if we get barrels that get racked too early in the barrel and they're krausening and they're making a mess, like, I want that stuff cleaned up immediately. I want barrels cleaned and scrubbed before we empty them. I want them cleaned and scrubbed again before we fill them. You know, and I think when you pay that attention to detail, you will find the problems, you know, and there's no better time to fix something than when you're actually working on it already. So,
absolutely.
I mean, it is possible to fill a barrel, and while you're filling the barrel, do something else, you know. Mm-hmm. And that something else better be looking at the next barrel, making sure it's clean, making sure, I mean, I'm a stickler for getting all of the staples and barrel labels from other wineries off of the barrels. You know, I want it mm-hmm. to be our thing. I don't want you to look at the barrel and see the history of where it was 2 years ago, you know. But I think that if you drive that attention to detail in every little facet, that, you know, your staff will start to do that as well. And eventually that all bleeds into the quality of the beer. So I'm a big proponent and believer that, you know, people make the beer. You know, the beer doesn't make itself. You have to have, you know, people who are focused on the small things to make good beer.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. If you get a new shipment in, what's your processes on new barrels when you're getting them? You know, are you taking the heads off? How are you inspecting those to make sure that they're
up to
your standards?
Oh, no, no. Yeah, definitely not taking the heads off. I've taken the heads off of barrels here more to show the guys how barrels are made and how you work on barrels. And then we have done some open top barrel fermentations. But generally speaking, when we receive barrels, there is no better barrel tool, in my opinion, than the human nose. Mm-hmm. So that's a big deal with me too. Like, you cannot fill a barrel without smelling it. You know, you have to get your nose in it, and you have to look for things, you know. And the biggest thing you're looking for is, in wine barrels, would be VA, And VA is an acronym for volatile acidity. Mm-hmm. The way that translates into the beer world is you think ethyl acetate, acetone, nail polish remover. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can get a lot of wine barrels in that have that character. That's a barrel that you don't want to use. Yeah, I mean, it's not going to do anything good for you. The way, in my opinion, the way to stay away from barrels like that is to stay away from barrel brokers as much as you can. And I know that's not a popular thing in the beer world, because in the beer world, you know, a lot of barrels are sourced through brokers. And I think that's fair and that's fine for spirit barrels and whatnot. But with wine barrels, you know, they need to be handled and they need to be maintained when they're empty. And that sometimes I don't think you get quite the maintenance from a broker as you would from a winery. So I actually have the luxury of being in California.
Yeah.
And then I also have the luxury of being in the wine business. So I, you know, I have a lot of friends that I can reach out to and source barrels from. So I get some pretty good quality barrels in. But basically, to return to your question, I actually just got 156 barrels in on Monday. And we bottled Monday and Tuesday. We're not bottling today. So I basically have my whole staff is out there today checking those barrels into inventory, and then inspecting the outsides, the insides, and then gassing them until they're ready for use. And basically what we do here is we do an ozone gas on the barrels. So we fill the barrels with ozone gas and then tape them up, and we'll set them aside. And we can do that pretty successfully to hold barrels. In the wine world, you use a lot of sulfur to store barrels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ozone is just as good. The only thing with it is you need to redo it every month. I know a lot of beer guys do a storage solution in barrels. I'm not a huge fan of that, strictly because of the amount of labor required to deal with the barrels. So I hate spending labor to maintain empty barrels, but sometimes it's necessary. But the whole gig is to fill them and keep them full. You know, the less empty barrels you have, the better. So hopefully that answers your question a little bit anyway.
Yeah. Do you guys steam your barrels at all?
We do, yeah, for many different reasons. Sometimes a barrel will be empty far too long and dry.
Mm-hmm.
And the easiest way to help do that is to rehydrate the barrel with steam. Steam is a good tool to use for that. But technically, my affinity for the steam machine is really about cleaning. So we will steam any barrel that's been empty for more than a couple weeks. We steam our puncheons quite regularly, so our primary fermentation fleet. We steam those. It depends. If they've been empty for more than a couple days, they get steamed before they're refilled. If they are just emptied that day, we won't really do much maintenance on them at all. We'll just put wort right back into them.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But steaming is a great tool for cleaning. The idea with steaming is, and once again, I'm speaking from the sour side, and speaking from what I do with wine barrels.
Sure.
This is definitely not what we do with our bourbon barrels on our clean side, but on our wine barrels, this is how we clean. So basically, we steam the barrel for about 10 minutes. And then we pull the steamer head out and we put a bung in the barrel. And basically what happens in this time frame is the steam that's in the barrel condenses as it cools, mm-hmm. condenses and turns into water. And as it condenses, it occupies less space than it did as steam. So basically inside that barrel, you've now created a negative pressure. And so you're actually pulling the steam, the hot steam opens up the wood pores. And then when you have that vacuum happening in there organically, it actually pulls stuff out of the pores into the barrel. So you're actually pulling, I don't know, old wine, sulfites, tannins. You're pulling all kinds of stuff out of the barrel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty amazing, especially if you have a fresh wine barrel, when you do that, because you will rinse the barrel first and it's just coming out clear water. And then you steam it, you apply this vacuum to it, and the other thing to note about this, if anybody's out there and is going to try this who hasn't done this before, it's very, very important to watch your vacuum on that barrel. You don't want to leave that bung in your barrel for more than 3 or 4 minutes because you can implode the barrel.
That's exciting.
That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, that would be really cool to watch.
You'll lose your barrel, and it'll scare the heck out of you. But basically, it's really interesting once you relieve that vacuum pressure and you turn the barrel upside down. If this was a red wine barrel, you'll see what looks like red wine coming out of the barrel. And so, you know, for me, like, that's a good thing. I know that I'm getting some potential contaminants out. And it's also very interesting, too. We also follow that steaming up with an ozone rinse. So we rinse with ozonated water. And ozone is, for those who don't know, ozone is molecularly, it's O3. It's oxygen with three molecules. So basically, it's an oxidizer. And that anything that respirates or breathes oxygen, if it breathes in this O3, it'll die. So you can kill a lot of different yeast. You can kill a lot of different bacteria. You can kill a lot of stuff with this. And it's important to note that, you know, the reason that we do this is to try to get clean. It's not to kill everything, because you're never going to kill everything. But I guess the thought is, like, if we can kill some bad stuff, you know, who cares if some good stuff dies too? Because eventually we're going to put that back in the beer, and we're not really stripping the barrel. A lot of people would think, oh, well, you're taking the culture from the barrel. But I don't really believe that. I just believe that, you know, what's wrong with cleaning something every once in a while? You know, you're trying to make as clean of a product as you can. So it's important to clean your vessels as well. I'm not a big proponent of, like, you know, the beer that was in there last is what's important for this new beer, you know. Also, here's another thing that the steaming and can help you with is if you are doing fruit additions or spice additions or these types of things to your barrels, it's very common that you may put cinnamon in this barrel, you know, and then you rack the beer out, you make this beer, and then you put some new beer in that barrel, and 6 months later you go and taste it, and you're like, man, this beer tastes like cinnamon. You know, well, it does, because it had cinnamon in the barrel, and somehow I think that if you would spend more time cleaning that barrel, that you might be able to get rid of some of that, you know?
Sure.
So that's one of the reasons that we do it.
Yeah, a lot easier with stainless. You give it a good caustic, exactly, and a good acid, and you're good to go. But barrels, yeah, there's a lot of nooks and crannies in there to hold whatever.
For sure.
Okay, we'll be right back with events. All right, everybody. That's so much information. I think my brain is going to explode. But here with some more information is Craig with events.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we got a couple cool things going on. This Wednesday the 14th, December 14th, we are doing a really cool beer dinner with Chef Tim Byers over at Smoke in Plano. And our very own Wim Benz, right across from me right now, will be there as well.
I will be there. I'll tell you about the beers. He will tell you about the awesome food.
Mm-hmm. They're going to be smoking some of their awesome meats over our barrel staves, actually. So definitely go get that. That's a very exclusive dinner, and it's pretty cool. It's going to be one of those special.
All I've read is German family style sausage madness platters.
Lots of, like, wild animal sausages.
And dried cherry thread spinner vinaigrette.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't get you excited, I think you're beyond all of our help.
Right. Oh, and you can also drink our bourbon barrel temperature.
Oh, of course. There's that too.
So there is that too. So don't miss out on that.
Yeah.
On Sunday, December 18th, we are going to be doing a couple of cool glass events. We're doing our Sin Mint glass at the tap room. Our brand new revival glass Sin Mint is going to be available that day. You can come in and buy the glass, and the beer is on us.
Keep the beer.
And then the game, now the Cowboys game, was supposed to be aired that day, and we were going to be having a watching party. Well, the Cowboys are so awesome right
now. Too good.
That they got moved to a night game, so unfortunately we won't have it. But we are going to have that football glass, that armchair quarterback glass available. So if you want to buy the glass, get the beer as well. We will have that available. In fact, we are going to be doing a lot of Cowboys watching parties, I feel like. They are moving along into the playoffs already. So pretty much any time we have our tap room open and a game is on, we're going to be showing it, and we're going to be celebrating with some
some awesome,
all the way to the Super Bowl,
awesome beers. So yeah,
so did I just jinx
and,
it?
And as always, yeah, yeah. Don't do not jinx that.
Don't you sports ball the Cowboys?
Cut that out. So and then always remember, we always have in our tap room our pitcher $10 pitcher deals on select drafts Monday through Thursday from 3 to 6, and we always do Geeks Who Drink trivia every Wednesday night, 7 p.m. Free to play. Come on out, it's lots of fun.
Cool beans.
Back to the show.
Back to the show.
Back to the show.
Let's learn some stuff. Let's just talk about barrel aging for a minute, because we are, for us, we're in bourbon barrel temptress season.
Yep.
And, you know, that's our kind of the white whale for Lakewood Brewing Company. You know, we had, how many, 60 to 70 casks, so bourbon barrels filled with BBT this year, and not all of them make it. You know, we take samples of every single one. We plate up every single one. Because you just have, you know, on the clean side of beer, you have one barrel that's got a little bit of PDO or lacto or bread in it, and it can really ruin the party because we blend everything together.
Yep.
So, so you know, on our side, on the clean side, it's making sure that every single barrel cuts the mustard, and not all of them do. So that's you know, I think a lot of people don't realize that when we put out X amount of bourbon barrel temptress, that there was a good portion that never made it.
Yeah, and I think you having that understanding and that attitude towards your beer is what makes that beer special. You know, it wouldn't be received the way it is if you didn't have that amount of care that you're putting into the blending of it.
Yeah.
So kudos to you guys.
Yeah.
It's an exceptional beer.
Thank you. I'll just tell our listeners a little story about BBT. BBT was a little bit of a mistake. It was the first time we ever brewed Temptress, which was back in probably July of 2012. So it was probably the third or fourth beer we ever brewed on the brew house. And it was the first time brewing Temptress on a production scale. And it just, it, you know, we had oats in that beer when we first started, and it gummed everything up in the mash tun, and we didn't hit our gravity, and it wasn't good enough to be Temptress, especially our first go, our first introduction to the market with that beer. And we're like, well, that's not going to work. Well, shit, let's get some barrels. Let's see what happens. So we ended up getting 12 bourbon barrels. And filling it up, and you know, just a few months later, we had bourbon barrel temptress for the first time, and it got up to the ABV that that we wanted it to, just by sitting in those barrels for a while. And
yeah, how much did it pick up?
Picked up a couple percent.
Yeah.
So
yeah, but that you know, that was the story of BBT. It was hey, let's see what happens. And I think as a brewery, You really got to learn how to make lemonade, because you're going to get a lot of lemons thrown at you.
Oh yeah,
you know,
for sure.
Shit happens every day. Things happen constantly.
I like that story, because you made it by mistake, but you know, you made it because your concept for it originally, like, it didn't quite fit where you wanted it to be. So
right.
You had to make the lemonade, you know, and it turned out to be something great. So, that wouldn't have happened if you didn't have attention to detail, you know. So I think it's a really good example of both of those points, of having a concept and working backwards, and then also like you said, making the lemonade. Like, mm-hmm. Hey, it didn't work, but it's not good enough to be what we wanted it to be. Let's see what we can do with it.
Yeah, let's make something different out of it, and cross our fingers. And you know, at the end of the day, if it hadn't worked, we would have dumped it. And and you know, we're proud that we send beer down the drain, because we're not putting it into the market.
Still hurts a little bit.
It hurts, but you know, I would much rather send bad beer down the drain than put it into somebody's glass, because that's, you know, our reputation is what we make.
Yeah, a lot of those beers that go down the drain have so much work in them too.
Yeah,
because you are trying to save it, and you are coming up with other things, and are trying different things, and spending more money, you know, and then eventually it's a hard decision, but. But usually when you get to that point of dumping it, it's the right decision. So.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Let's talk about how homebrewers can experiment with barrel aging. You know, if you have a big enough system and can fill a barrel, you might run down to your local brewery and say, hey, you guys getting emptying any barrels that I can use? But the easier way to get some of that wood flavor in your beer is to do chips or cubes.
Spirals.
Uh-huh. Yep. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
I actually believe that's a great way to work on it, especially in a small capacity. The other thing about filling a barrel as a home brewer, I mean, most home brewers are not working on, you know, huge systems. So there's a lot of work to fill a barrel. And then you have all your eggs in one basket, so to speak. And I know for myself, I don't sell any sour barrels to people, strictly because the ones that I'm not going to use are bad. And I'm not gonna lie to somebody and say they can make a good beer out of it, because I couldn't. So we do occasionally sell some of our bourbon barrels from the clean side, but I would caution most guys who want to do sour stuff away from bourbon barrels, strictly because it's in my opinion, it's an inferior holding vessel for beer. Yeah, as compared to a wine barrel anyway. And, you know, like I said, it's just a gamble putting all of your homebrew into a barrel. So that being said, the adjunct thing, with whether it be chips, cubes, they also sell like sawdust you can use, spirals, all those kind of things. I think they're a really good way to get that oak flavor. And I don't know if you guys use any of that stuff in your barrels. We don't use any of that stuff in our barrels here, but in the wine world, it's very, very common to use spirals and staves in your barrels and then in your stainless tanks as well.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked at a winery before where we, in the 2.5 years I was there, we never bought a new barrel. So all of our oak came from adjuncts, you know. And I think it's really interesting, because if you are fortunate enough as a home brewer to get your hands on a bourbon barrel or a wine barrel that you think is good, and I'd caution all of you guys to really, you know, like I said earlier, use your nose, smell the barrel, those kind of things. If it don't smell good, it ain't good. But if you are fortunate enough to get your hands on something like that, and now you're kind of tied to that one barrel. So say if you get a 4-year-old, 5-year-old wine barrel, there's probably not a lot of oak left in it. If you do think there's oak left in it, it might be an American barrel, it might be a French barrel, it might be a Hungarian barrel. And if it is one of those three barrels, then it definitely is one of 3 to 5 different toast levels. It might be a medium toast with toasted heads or something like that, which is cool. So now you got yourself a medium toast, toasted head. Well, the only beer that you're going to pull out of that is going to be medium toast American oak, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you go the adjunct route, you know, you can buy some Hungarian cubes, and you can buy some American cubes, and you can buy some heavy toast French cubes, and you can actually kind of build an oak profile with a little sprinkle of this and a little cube of that and a spiral of this. And I think that's, to me, that'd be much more interesting than putting all your eggs in one basket,
sure,
like I said earlier, you know. So that is one thing about doing small projects, is you can, you know, I would rather have, you know, 10 5-gallon carboys of the same beer with different oak treatments than one barrel, you know. Because then you set yourself up with all these blending opportunities, you know. Like, hey, maybe if we took these 10 gallons with that 5 gallons and made this beer, you know, and then you could do that. And to me, that you get much more mileage out of that. Mm-hmm. It's all about the tools that you set yourself up with. And so, you know, Wim, you could probably chime in on this too. It's so much easier to make a lot of beer than it is to make a little amount of beer. So hats off to the home brewers, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that's a challenge.
Absolutely. It takes about as long to make 5 gallons as it does 5,000 gallons. So,
right.
Yeah. But, you know, for a home brewer, it's a labor of love, right? Same thing for same thing for us. I think Tommy had another question.
I was just going to add on to the splitting beer up and kind of the for the home brewer side of it. If you are trying to make sour beer at home, you know, splitting your batches up is one of the best things you can do, because you can experiment with that. You can use different oaks, you can use different bugs if you want. If you want to use dregs from your favorite bottles, do that, and you can get some really, really interesting beers out of it.
For sure. Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more, especially with the propensity of, you know, sour beer to take a turn and go bad. It'd be much, much easier on you to lose 5 gallons of your cellar than to lose the whole thing, you know.
Now, also a good learning experience. You can figure out what works and what doesn't. And
yeah.
For next time, you're a little bit more prepared even.
I had a quick question about, you mentioned earlier that you do a little bit of open fermentation on some of your barrels. Are you guys playing around with any spontaneous, you know, fermentation, any kind of cool ship type of action there?
Not successfully.
Yeah.
We do play around with it a little bit, and I do have a project that I would like to get off the ground this winter time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably going to create some sort of cool ship type spontaneous thing that will probably involve my staff hanging out and drinking beers and camping in the parking lot.
Yeah.
But I think that might be the more value part of it than the actual spontaneous thing.
Yeah.
So, no, not a ton of spontaneous stuff yet. It's not really what we do.
Yeah.
But I do want to play with it. But what I have played with here recently is more of a native fermentation concept. In other words, you know, in winemaking, if you there's a big trend, you know, now there's a big label for it, natural wine. In winemaking, if you were to bring grapes in and crush them and then not pitch any sort of yeast or anything, mm-hmm. you're basically doing what's known as a native fermentation. So you're letting the native microflora, in this case it would be yeast, Saccharomyces yeast, you're basically letting that take over.
Mm-hmm.
In wine, the thing is with that is you're usually not sulfiting things, so you have PDO in there, you have lacto, and you have bread in there, and you're just hoping that the Saccharomyces is going to take over and dominate the fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, that's native winemaking. So you're just letting it do what it does. So basically, I do a lot of wine-beer hybrids here, and we've made some really good ones that I'm pretty proud of, and I have some in barrel right now that are representative of this new style that I'm trying. So this native fermentation, basically what I'm doing is I'm bringing grapes in, and then we're just knocking out wort right on top of the grapes. And
that's cool.
We're letting the microflora on the grapes take over the wort and be the workhorse of fermentation.
That is pretty cool.
So when you do that, it's really important to make sure that you're actually feeding that yeast, that it is a happy environment. So, I mean, I think that's like the one trick, but, you know, that's something that I'm experimenting with now is like, you know, it's spontaneous in nature,
mm-hmm.
you know, but it's not spontaneous to this place.
Right.
So to speak. Mm-hmm. Now, that being said, it's native, right? So the microflora that's on the fruit is doing the fermentation, but it is open top in my cellar. So it is getting some stuff, but really it's the fruit that's doing the heavy work. And honestly, this year, we did it. I had 3 open top like wine fermenters in the cellar that we were punching down and working with, and it was actually quite stressful because we knocked out this wort and we did the native thing, and for like 5 days nothing was happening. Nothing. Like it was just wort floating on top
biter.
Of grapes.
Oh, yeah. No.
And I was like, you know, every day I'd walk by it and I'd look at it and I'd, you know, kind of hang over the tank and, like, you know, spend 5-10 minutes, like, scratching my head thinking about it. And then I would tell myself, like, we're okay. We're okay today. You know, mm-hmm. let's look at this tomorrow. And I was really getting to the point where I was like, this is not going well. You know, this is a problem. I may have, you know, stretched this too far. And then I came in the next morning and I pulled the cover off and I was blasted with CO2, and I was like, oh, thank God, you know, as I was crying because the CO2 was in my eyes, I was like, thank
right.
God, it finally started.
That's
know?
Awesome.
Yeah, so that's something that I don't know how that's going to turn out. I'll probably know this time next year.
Yeah.
But I'm excited about the prospect of, you know, you know, trying something new. So.
That's cool. That's what it's all about, is experimentation and trying new things. So,
yeah, for sure.
That's awesome.
Absolutely. Well, hey, we got to wrap it up. We are unfortunately out of time. This has been an awesome, just eye-opening conversation, and it's something that I think a lot of people are interested in. Hopefully our listeners really enjoy this as well. Jeremy Grinke, production manager at Brewery Taru.
Taru.
There we go. I pronounced it right this time.
Correct.
Brewery Taru. Hey, man, thank you so much for joining us and giving us a lot of things to think about. Any beers that we should be trying from the brewery or the Brewery Taru that are available now?
Yeah. What should you try? Well, I'll tell you what. I talked a lot about the Frucht project we're working on.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of our fooder beer, our quicker turn fooder beer. You're going to be seeing that a lot out in distribution, and it's a fairly low price point. It's accessible, and it's generally, depending on the fruit re-fermentation, it's between 4.5% and 5% alcohol.
Perfect.
Probably perfect for that Texas heat.
You bet.
You know, so. Grab a bottle of that at one of the shops out there and throw that down and let me know what you guys think. Yeah, Tommy, Zach, Craig, Wim, thanks so much for getting a hold of me and letting me come on, and appreciate the time.
You bet, man.
It was great talking to you, man.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We hope to have you again. Have fun out there and keep experimenting and keep doing what you do. We really appreciate the fruits of your labor.
Right on. Cheers, guys.
All right, everybody. Oof, that was a good one.
I know, it's amazing.
That was a good one.
I need some barrel-aged beer in my belly.
I need to go get some brewery beers.
Brewery. They're so good. Human language cannot encapsulate them.
Mm-hmm. So good. Oh, God. All right, guys. Well, thanks for listening. This has been Taproom Talks.
Stay with it.
This has been Taproom Talks with Lakewood Brewing Company. From all of us to all of you, thank you so much for listening. If you like us, tell a friend. Find us on iTunes and Google Play. You can follow us at lakewoodbrewing.com, Twitter, or Instagram at Lakewood Brewing for all your internet pleasures. Well, your internet Lakewood Brewing beer mm-hmm. company
all these,
pleasures.
These violent delights.
These violent delights bring violent beer.
Tasty ends.
Yeah. Farewell to 2016.
See you 2016.
Yeah, we'll see you in 2017, jeez, everyone.
Yeah, we've had it with you. Go home 2016.
Yeah,
you're drunk.
You're too bad. Cool. All right.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next year. Hello and welcome, everyone. This is Taproom Talks with Lakewood Brewing Company. I am Wim Benz, founder and president of Lakewood Brewing Company. As always, we're here with Craig Bradley and Zach Phillips, our creative department.
Hello. Hi, guys.
We also have Tommy Gutierrez here. He is our brewer and the barrel aficionado for Lakewood Brewing Company. And today, we have a very special guest. We have... Sorry, I have to... Get your card out so I can know how to pronounce your last name. Let's try this again.
Cool card.
Cool card.